welcome to another edition of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. This is Dr. Z, Dr. Eugene Zampro, naturopathic physician, herbalist with the American Herbalist Guild, one of the founders of the College of Naturopathic Medicine on the East Coast here in Bridgeport, Connecticut, and your host for this edition of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. So we have a great program today with an author that I've been a fan of for quite some time, and his name is Stephen Buhner. And Stephen is the award-winning author of 15 books on nature, indigenous cultures, the environment, herbal medicine. He comes from a long line of healers, including Leroy Burney, Surgeon General of the United States under Eisenhower and Kennedy, and many other physicians, including his grandfather, C.G. Harrod, who used botanical medicines in rural Indiana as a physician in 1911. Stephen's work has appeared in publications throughout North America and Europe, in many magazines, even mainstream media as well. And he lectures yearly throughout the United States on herbal medicine, the sacredness of plants, the intelligence of nature, the states of mind needed for successful habitation of the earth. And on today's show, we're going to talk about healing Lyme, and particularly the co-infections of Lyme, but we'll probably touch base on Lyme disease, too, and talk about its insidious nature. And his website is GuyanStudies.org. We'll give more information on that later on in the program, but without further ado, Stephen, are you there?
I am here. Hello.
Oh, nice to meet you. At least
thanks for having me on.
Program here, and happy to have you on there. Well, like I said, I've been a fan of your books there, written just spectacularly with the scientific information out there on Lyme disease and some of your other topics, of course. But today we're going to talk a little bit about the co-infections that Lyme disease, that happens when you get bit by, you know, one of these arthropods, one of these ticks. So tell us a little bit about how these co-infections kind of came about, because years ago people would only check for Lyme disease, and it would be by luck of the draw that maybe the doxycycline that was used, if it was effective at all, would touch the co-infections, but we're finding that it's not.
Yeah, that's really true. And you know, the way this whole thing is kind of developed over time, you have to realize that Lyme disease, even though all of the Lyme group has been around for thousands of years, they've only been identified fairly recently. And Lyme just happened to be the first one that was discovered by, I forget the guy's name for first name, but it's Willy Burgdorfer, I think that's who it was. And mm-hmm. Which is why they named the Lyme spirochete after him as a result. And he discovered it, as I recall, I think in the late 70s or early 80s. So it became kind of this thing, and everybody began looking at Lyme because it turned out it was really endemic in a number of areas in the country. And the first place they discovered it was, and where he did his research, was in Lyme, Connecticut, which is why it got called Lyme disease.
Right.
And, I mean, it's really, that term is sort of taken over. They're never really going to get rid of it. But the problem, as they've begun to learn more about what's going on, it turns out that there's really seven or eight different disease pathogens that are commonly passed in this process. And Lyme, because it was the first one discovered, then they started seeing that there were others, so they called those co-infections of Lyme. But really, what we're seeing is a group of arthropod-transmitted diseases, which are pretty much called stealth pathogens, is a really good way to describe them. And a number of researchers are referring to them as second-generation microbial pathogens, meaning we've already kind of handled the easy ones with antibiotics and stuff, all the ones that people have been working on since World War II when antibiotics started becoming common. These others don't tend to respond well to antibiotics. They sequester themselves in the body in hard-to-reach places, and they're very good at hiding. So, you know, even though my book calls them co-infections and people talk about it, really it's a group of disease pathogens that are extremely hard to treat and are easily transmitted by many arthropod vectors, not just ticks.
Yeah, and sometimes when you use the word co-infection, it kind of demeans their importance. I can see where you're coming from, and that some of these are very difficult to treat, and like you said, hide in strange areas of the body where the circulation tends to be low, where the temperature tends to be cooler in the body, and sometimes they put out a whole slew of camouflage chemicals, and sometimes they stimulate the immune system and what you call the cytokine pathways, you know, which is well known in medicine. A lot of the biological drugs that they use for rheumatology, which is the field that myself and Dr. Kammeyer are very knowledgeable in and have written books in, they seem to trigger those types of pathways and cause chronic inflammation. So in your book, which are the ones that, I know you wrote mostly about mycoplasma and Bartonella, which we'll talk about, but there's other ones too.
Yeah, the ones that I consider the kind of the primary ones, and you have to understand, again, that the research on all of this is extremely new. Really only in about the last 15 or 20 years have people been kind of discovering these and doing research on them. And the research starts off extremely slow. So, you know, in a lot of ways, most of the research that I looked at in my books is less than 10 years old, and that's very little. So, you know, the first book I did was on Lyme disease in 95, and then the second one that just came out is on Mycoplasma and Bartonella, and there's one coming out late next year on Babesia, Ehrlichia, and Anaplasma.
Right.
And so those are kind of the major six, but then there's, you know, tick-borne encephalitis is sort of part of that group, and then there's Rocky Mountain spotted fever and just a couple of others that are getting less play because they're somewhat less common.
Right.
But I think those are probably, those first group, those six are probably the major ones at this point. But what's interesting is when I was doing work on the first Lyme book in 95, these other ones just weren't recognized as being that much of an influence. And it's turning out Bartonella, for instance, is at least as prevalent as Lyme, and it's much more difficult to treat. So there's a lot of learning. We're on a really
steep
learning curve here.
And there's a lot of species of these things. You go over in one of your chapters, go over quite a number of the species of different, for instance, in, let's talk about Mycoplasma for a little while. There's so many species, including Pneumoniae, which most mainstream labs test for, which can cause all kinds of eye infections, ear infections. Of course, pneumoniae is, I guess, a term meaning can cause clearly pneumonia and upper respiratory things. But then you talk about that it can cause GI problems, can cause autoimmune disease in the kidneys, and then most interesting to me, being that I do a lot of work with rheumatoid arthritis and things like that, is quite a bit of the work on mycoplasma being the main cause of rheumatoid arthritis, which is kind of, you know, to a rheumatologist is a very striking discussion in of itself. So these mycoplasma, they can cause genital infections in people and all kinds of things like that. So these mycoplasmas have been around for a very long time. Is that correct?
Yeah, hundreds of millions of years. I mean, they're long, long living. I mean, they have a really ancient history. They predate our emergence as a species by a very long time, and they've been at their job a long time. They're really good at it. And one of the things, just to sort of set context, is all of these co-infectious, or these the Lyme group of infectious organisms, they're all parasites in a sense, in that they scavenge the nutrients they need from whatever organism they tend to infect. And so that's one of the things you have to understand. Everything that they do in the body is an attempt to get the nutrients that they need to survive. So, and mycoplasma, for instance, is, it's relatively new to, you know, medical researchers in a lot of ways, even though a few of the organisms they've known about for, you know, 70, 80 years maybe. The thing is, what happened is mycoplasmas are extremely tiny. They're probably, if not the tiniest bacteria, certainly the closest to it. And what happened is the researcher just inadvertently discovered that his experiments that he was doing on a certain bacteria, that his petri dishes were infected with mycoplasma, because they're so tiny that they weren't even looking for them, and there's so many different kinds that it's hard to find them. And so he began doing research and found out virtually every laboratory experiment that everybody done for the last, what, 50 years or so, they'd been infected with these bacteria. So people really then began to look for them, and it turns out that they've, you know, discovered over 200 different ones at this point, but researchers say that's probably only about 1%, if we're lucky, of the full range of mycoplasma organisms. And at this point, I mean, the research is, every day they're learning something new and they're finding a new one. At this point, they found about 30 different ones that infect human beings. And so because they're so tiny, they need to actually scavenge more nutrients from their host than almost any of the, well, than any of the others in these, this group of Lyme infectious agents. So they're much more difficult to treat, much more difficult to understand, and they can basically infect any part of the body. If you can think of it, they've been there.
Yeah, and I can see that they will live off your different amino acids that we have, and they'll actually use some of your RNA and DNA. And that, of course, is interesting because, you know, I'm doing a big lecture out in San Diego on autoimmune disease at the Restorative Medicine Conference coming up in October this year. And one of the things I'm interested in is, you know, when the cells are lysed by some of these microbes or other factors that, that do these things, instigators as I call them, and ATP and ADP and some of these things are released outside the cell, that can actually trigger a lot of autoimmunity as some of the antigen-presenting cells come in there and then see this stuff which has been immunologically privileged. In other words, for the listeners out there, following, you know, some of the, sometimes inside the stuff inside our cells, way deep in our DNA and nucleus, has probably never seen the outside of the cell. So to our immune system, it looks like foreign material. So we don't know whether the immune system is constantly responding to the mycoplasma, or is it responding to our innards, so to speak, cellular innards that have been spilled over. What's your thoughts on that, Steve?
Well, it's really the immune system is really responding to both. And ATP and ADP, they're highly reactive in the body. They cause a lot of responses. They're molecular, just very active. So, but basically, what the mycoplasma does, and what all of these group of organisms do, is they get in the body, and the very first thing they do, well, the mycoplasma basically go through some sort of mucous membrane route, usually, to get in the body. Either you ingest them, so they go through the GI tract, or you breathe them in and they go through the respiratory tract, or they go in through the urinogenital tract. And those are kind of the major routes of entry. And a lot of them will just stay there. Then some of them will tend to go deeper in the system. And they have mechanisms for getting in where they can't be seen very well by the immune system. They tend to hide inside other cells that they have an affinity for. And so as soon as they get in the body, they'll tend to release a chemoattractant that will either pull them to the cell that they want or pull the cell to them. And then they'll, once they're at the place they need, they'll release another chemical that will begin to break that cell apart so they can get inside of it and hide, essentially. And then if they go someplace else in the body, like if, you know, one of the major problems for mycoplasma, if they get into the central nervous system where they can cause a lot of neurological problems that are really severe, then when they get there, what they do is that they stimulate the cell that they're inside of to release other chemical markers that then pull parts of the immune system to that location. And that starts kind of an auto-inflammatory process in the body. So they basically subvert our own kind of healing processes for their own ends, and that begins to break other cells in that location apart so that the mycoplasma, after they, you know, reproduce inside of a cell, then they kind of burst out, and there's all these nutrients available for them, and then they hide inside other cells. So you get this complicated mix of the mycoplasma themselves, the body's trying to deal with that, and then at the same time, the mycoplasma are subverting the body's own healing mechanisms to cause cells to break apart or lyse so that they can get nutrients. And so that's one of the reasons why kind of traditional medicine has a hard time dealing with it, because they're very, very sophisticated.
And then they could actually stop the cells from dying, too. So then they can manipulate it the other way too, right?
Yeah, you're right. I mean, one of the mechanisms our body has is if a cell gets infected, the body, you know, stimulates kind of a self-destruct signal.
Right.
And we've got this little Star Trek episode thing. And then the cell starts to die. And basically then what the number of these co-infections can do, especially mycoplasma, like, no, I'm not going to let you die. You have to keep producing stuff for me. And so they shut it down, so you keep getting, the infection can't really be stopped. And one of the unique things I wanted to mention about mycoplasma is because they keep cells alive like that for a very long time, they actually stimulate the development of cancer. And a number of cancers, it come from very long-term mycoplasma infections, and where the cells just basically finally take off on their own.
Yeah, and then as far as rheumatology goes, going back to my favorite topic there, you talk about, on page 87, you talk about its impact on the synovial tissue. So, you know, some people think that Lyme and the co-infections actually invades the joints, which it can. But then also, it creates, like you were mentioning, some type of a influx of fluid into the joints, and then that creates problems with drainage, and then
right.
It recruits the immune system. So it can actually damage the connective tissue as well.
Yeah, it does. And like Lyme disease, for instance, it's really fond of collagen tissues. That's its primary area of scavenging, and so wherever it scavenges that material is where you get your symptoms. So, you know, the cartilage in the body has a lot of collagen in it, so they break that down to get nutrients. And most of the co-infectious bacteria actually have a fondness for that tissue group. So the mycoplasma, once they get in there, they'll start this kind of recurring inflammation that you just can't ever seem to get rid of. And the fascinating thing there's a lot of fascinating things for me about these organisms. They're incredibly intelligent, incredibly ancient, and really interesting. And the thing is, a lot of the diseases that human beings have had for a long time that more reductionistic medicine hasn't been able to figure out, it's starting to turn out a lot of them come from organisms like this that were just too small to see, or we weren't looking for them, or, you know, it was just they were sort of existed in this area that technological medicine couldn't see. And now that they're being seen, we're starting to go like, oh, a lot of Parkinson's disease or MS are caused by these organisms, Alzheimer's sometimes, rheumatoid arthritis. So there's a route to what stimulates a lot of these diseases, and it's just, we just aren't as smart as we think we are, and it takes us a long time to catch up with organisms that are several hundred million years old.
Let's jump to Bartonella, and then we'll talk a little bit about the diagnosis of these diseases, and then spend, you know, a lot of time talking about treatment. So talk a little bit about the second group of stealth pathogens that you talk about in the book, Bartonella.
Well, Bartonella is extremely common, and one of the weird things that I have run into in my research, because I read, I think, for this about 3,000 journal articles and all of the books that I could find on, you know, each of these diseases, and the thing is that the CDC will say, oh, Lyme disease, there's only about 40,000 people a year infected, or there's only about 22,000 people a year infected with Bartonella. But the researchers are incredibly clear about this, you know, that with Lyme, there's at least 500,000 new infections a year. And with Bartonella, it turns out, just looking at the research journals, I mean, this isn't anything like strange that's coming from out of left field. This is in all of the mainstream medical stuff. There's probably about 40 million people in the United States asymptomatically infected with Bartonella. It's very common, and the same is true of Mycoplasma, that you just don't show symptoms. But the other fascinating thing about this group is that every researcher that's worked with it says the same thing. If your immune function begins to fall, then what happens is the disease symptoms begin to blossom. So the better the immune function, you know, you may have the disease, but you remain asymptomatic. So the thing is with Bartonella, it specializes in mammal infection, and it really likes to infect mammals that have a lot of relationship with human beings, whether it's agricultural animals or pets or whatever.
Right.
So about half of all cats are infected with Bartonella, about a quarter of all dogs. But then you start looking at veterinarians, and the research finds that about half of all veterinarians are infected with Bartonella. Any animal, people that work around animals, agricultural workers and so on, and people that have pets. Bartonella is transmitted by pretty much every biting insect you can think of. It's, you know, I think I have a list of 12 or 14 in there. And homeless people, you know, it's transmitted by body lice, pubic lice, head lice. It's transmitted by fleas so that your animals get it. And then as the cats, for instance, scratch themselves or whatever, the flea feces gets on their claws, and if they scratch you, then it's transmitted into you. So it's an extremely common
the old cat scratch fever
disease, and
right.
We see more and more of it. Probably the two major ones we see now are Lyme and Bartonella. And Bartonella, really clever organism. It what it does is it likes blood cells, particularly. And so what it does is it secretes itself in the endothelial tissues of the blood vessels all around the body, and then it causes kind of a hyperplasia or an overgrowth of endothelial cells. It stimulates that so it has more room to live in, and then every so often on a regular schedule it will release its new bacteria into the bloodstream, and they then go inside blood cells and live there and gather nutrients and until the blood cells break apart, and then they go back into the endothelial cells and then make more of themselves. So it's a really common disease. It causes massive problems in neurological symptoms are very common. Bone pain, especially in the foot's common. So it's a wide complex of effects, and chronic fatigue is very common with almost all of these organisms.
Well, you know, here's a monkey wrench in the whole thing that I'm sure naysayers have presented to you and whatnot, and myself too, being a naturopath. You know, does presence of these organisms really prove causality and infection type of thing? Because, you know, you kind of have to look at the definition of infection. You know, if someone doesn't have classic cat scratch fever with, you know, their inguinal nodes swelling and et cetera, et cetera. You know, just because you can find the bug doesn't mean that it's causing an infection. And that kind of is, I'm just throwing that out there. I mean, I don't believe that, but I'm throwing that out there to you because I know you could, you can answer that question.
Yeah, that, and that's one of the problems that, you know, there actually haven't been any naysayers so far because I really did my homework on this one. It's like, it's really because I quote so many of the researchers so consistently throughout the book. And part of the problem is the way physicians work, which many, many people know now, isn't actually very effective. They spend, you know, maybe 10 or 15 minutes with a client, and they very, very few of them have time to actually research disease or understand it very well. Once they get out of school, they just sort of treat stuff.
Right.
And so they tend to use really basically outdated texts to understand disease, if they even have time to look at them much. So, you know, you mentioned cat scratch fever, which for a lot of physicians, there's really only a couple of kinds of Bartonella infections that they think exist.
Right.
One of them, the most common one for human beings, is called cat scratch fever. So, of course, as a medical herbalist and working in that field, most of the people we have contact with are people that have gone the traditional route and haven't been helped. So we see people usually that have been misdiagnosed for a long period of time or for whom antibiotics didn't work or whatever. And we hear lots of very horrible stories about it, and where they go in and the doctor says, do you have a cat? And they go, no. And they go, well, then you don't have Bartonella. And the thing is, even if somebody does have Bartonella, the tests are not very good. But a lot of times they can only test for a couple of different species of Bartonella. And there's, I think, 14 or 17 now that routinely infect human beings, and they're finding more all of the time. So the tests generally have to be very specific, and there's a lot of problem with false negatives. So the researchers, you know, back to your original point, the researchers have been extremely good at testing for the various organisms because the researchers are not treatment-oriented necessarily. They just want to understand the organism. They want to understand how prevalent it is. They don't have a political agenda. They're not being paid by pharmaceutical companies.
Right.
You know, they just want to know, and it's science in the kind of way that a lot of people think it is done, but isn't really done as much as people think. And so they've found that the infectious spectrum is extremely broad, that the symptom picture is extremely varied depending upon the species, depending upon the infectious route, depending upon, because it's not just, for instance, cats. You can get bit by your dog and have a transmission that way.
Mm-hmm.
You can get bit by mosquitoes or biting flies or midges and have it transmitted that way. Although it has, all of the Bartonella tend to have an affinity for red blood cells and endothelial tissues. Not all of them are heavily infective in the lymph nodes, like the agent of cat scratch fever tends to be, so you don't have that huge swelling in the lymph nodes. So it's just the problem, as many researchers have said, is that these are very sophisticated stealth pathogens, and they demand a much different treatment approach. They demand you have to spend a lot longer with your patients, at least an hour per patient, which very few physicians will do. Your tests and your thinking have to be extremely sophisticated, and you have to, your treatment intervention has to be extremely sophisticated. So because just almost always a straight antibacterial approach will not work.
Right. So on that note, it's half past the hour, and we'll take a quick break. And we'll be back. We're going to talk about a little bit more about diagnosis and then spend most of the time about treatment, because as holistic practitioners, we believe that, you know, we're not big proponents of the germ theory. We feel like if we can marshal the patient's immune system and the intelligence within, then the body can defeat these organisms or at least live in some type of a steady state with them versus, kind of a militaristic, mechanistic viewpoint of, controlling nature versus working with nature, the vitalistic viewpoint. So we'll talk more about that when we return right here on The Natural Nurse and Doctor. Stay tuned.
On this edition of The Natural Medicine Chest, we'll discuss jojoba, the miracle plant of the desert.
Jojoba is spelled J-O-J-O-B-A, but is pronounced according to its Spanish origins. The jojoba plant grows in the American Southwest and the Sonoran Desert in Mexico. The jojoba is a large bush-like plant resembling mistletoe. It can reach a height of 15 feet and can live from 100 to 200 years. The Sonoran Indians have used the oil pressed from the jojoba beans for centuries. Father Juniper Serra, founder of 21 missions in California, noted in the early 1700s that the local Indians were using jojoba oil for treating sores, cuts, bruises, burns, and as a diet supplement, to soothe skin from sun and wind burns, as a cooking oil, and even as a beverage.
The importance of jojoba as a cash crop was proclaimed in 1935, but it was not until 1974, when the killing of sperm whales was banned, that the government began to study jojoba oil in depth as a substitute for whale oil. The National Academy of Sciences concluded jojoba oil has a radically different chemical structure than any other known oil. Most oils break down or turn rancid. Jojoba, on the other hand, is hypoallergenic, non-toxic, never turns rancid, and does not break down even under high temperature and pressure.
The University of California at Riverside did a study where they cooked 27 batches of popcorn in the same heated jojoba oil. The last batch was just as perfect as the first. These unusual properties are unique to jojoba oil because, chemically speaking, jojoba oil is not really an oil at all, but is a liquid wax. Its composition is almost identical to sebum, which is the oil secreted by human sebaceous glands to help to protect the skin from the environment.
Jojoba has a myriad of usages. The cosmetic industry takes advantage of its compatibility to human skin by adding it to shampoos, conditioners, moisturizers, and many other cosmetic products. In medicine, jojoba can be used directly on rashes, cuts, and psoriasis. It may also be used as a lubricant for artificial hearts. Jojoba contains a natural appetite suppressant, which can be used in weight loss products. It has no known side effects. In industry, jojoba is known to be a superior engine lubricant and will cause a car to run 20 to 30 degrees cooler when added to the crankcase oil.
So, if you are interested in a miracle plant from the desert, reach for jojoba in your natural medicine chest.
Okay, and we're back with more of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. We're real happy to have on Stephen Buhner talking about co-infections, Lyme disease, and particularly mycoplasma and Bartonella. Stephen, are you there?
I am.
Great. Now, like I was talking about before, you know, we can look at the things mechanistically and use herbs in place of antibiotics, or we can think outside the box and look at this more in a holistic paradigm and don't just do green allopathic medicine as is quoted by many of our colleagues in lectures and whatnot. So, but first, before we talk about treatment, why are they hard to diagnose? It seems like they hide. And what can we do as practitioners if we want to run lab work to try to ascertain a person's infectivity?
Well, that's, I talk about that in the book as much as I possibly could, from looking at the work that the researchers had done. And that's not really sort of my, I can talk about it a little bit, but
okay.
It's not really my area of expertise, because most of the people that I see have already sort of gone through that route.
I see.
And they already either know what they have or what they don't have. And sometimes we can tell just from their symptom picture that they've been misdiagnosed for a long time, and we approach it that way. Part of the reason why the more medical technical diagnostics don't work well is, okay, just to look at Lyme, but this applies to all of these organisms.
Right.
They're extremely genetically flexible. I mean, they're, for a long time, and many people still believe this, that DNA is like building blocks, like a bunch of bricks in a certain order. But it's really been known to have the people in the know for since the late 50s that DNA is a highly flexible organ of the cell. The genome of the body is highly flexible, and it can rearrange itself a lot. And in these kind of organisms, it's highly flexible, so which means within just a few minutes, these organisms can completely restructure their genomic makeup. And as they do that, they begin to restructure their physical makeup as well, which one of the things they constantly change is their outer protein coat, which is how the body then identifies the organism. So whenever these organisms go in a human body, they immediately, or in any infectious host, in any host they infect, they immediately begin creating multiple genomic variants of themselves located at various parts of the body. It's more accurate to think of them as an intelligent swarm rather than a bunch of individual bacteria that are in the body. And so the immune system then will identify one protein coat and be able to attack it successfully, but there's already multiple other variants sequestered, and as soon as one is broken down, the others begin to release, and all the time they're constantly generating variants.
Mm-hmm.
And that creates the same kind of problem for diagnostics as it does for our immune system, because the diagnostics that they use, they're identifying something on the protein coat, on the outer surface of the bacteria, to try to identify what it is. So you've got that problem. Another problem that you have is that the numbers of the bacteria in the body tend to be low. So even with Lyme, where there's the bullseye rash, where you know there's spirochetes in the skin spreading out, which is what's causing that rash, they've taken biopsies of the skin and still been unable to locate spirochetes in there. So there's a number problem, and then there's also that there's so many different species anyway of these bacteria, like 14 to 17 that infect humans of the Bartonella, 30 that infect human of Mycoplasma so far, that they have to create a test for each one of those particular species. But they're discovering new ones, like literally every month, practically. So what happens is they'll have a test that's maybe only good for two of them or three of them. And all of this stuff, because they're so new, because of all of these factors, the diagnostic tests are often, I mean, they're just very difficult to rely on. It's not like, you know, going, oh, you have a strep infection or something like that.
Right.
So you have to have a series of tests, usually Western blot or ELISA or PCR. There normally needs to be a couple of those tests that are used together, because that lowers the chance of an error and increases the ability to find the organism. And then you have to look at the symptom picture as well at the same time, which means you have to have some sort of a feel for how the organism works in the body, which you don't usually get until after you've worked with the group of people that are infected by it for a while. But there's certain sort of rule of thumb diagnostic presenting factors. Mycoplasma is a tough one because it often presents as nutrient depletion or an infection in a mucous membrane system that just won't resolve. And you get that sort of thing together. Bartonella is a little bit easier to diagnose. I mean, if you've got somebody that's coming in to you that where you see anemia is one of the major things that can show up, recurrent fever of unexplained origin, recurrent headache. Photophobia is extremely common in Bartonella. Bone pain, neurological problems, especially if there's homicidal rage. The Bartonella tend to infect the amygdala in the brain, which causes these really wide-ranging emotional outbursts, especially with rage, memory loss. And basically, I pretty much look at if there's bone pain, unexplained cough, photophobia, severe fatigue, and memory impairment. If you get that grouping together, it's extremely indicative that there's a Bartonella infection.
Now, one of the ways that the old timers and I teach history and natural medicine at the University of Bridgeport. One of my classes I teach, and I go back to look at Dr. Nicholas Minardis, who did a lot of treatment of syphilis back in the 1500s, and Minardis prided himself in using three main therapies. He used guaiacum tincture, he used Smilax or sarsaparilla, and he also did fever treatments where he would bring the patient's temperature up to a feverish range, and he had remarkable success, whereas the allopaths at the time were bleeding people and treating them with mercury and things like that. The point I'm trying to make is that, you know, one thing that he did that was very interesting that we like to do in naturopathic medicine is hyperthermia treatments, and also maybe fast patients, and try to marshal the vital force of the patient with the thinking that the organism may outsmart the antibiotics, even the herbs, but it's not going. And it might hide in a particular part of the body, but it's not going to escape a raging fever, even if it's created artificially. Now, I've had tremendous success in my practice getting people over Lyme disease by basically cooking them in a way. And I know it's, you know, naturopathic doctors use a lot of hydrotherapy because the roots of our medicine are in the Germanic hydrotherapists, Kniep and all these ones, Father Kniep and Priesnitz and people like that. So that's my unique way of dealing with them, plus using a lot of the botanicals that I'd like you to talk about. So talk about some of the herbal protocols that you think would be effective to manage these things.
Well, the interesting thing is if, like, looking at Bartonella, once my approach has been really different than technological medical practitioners, and I have a huge respect for bacterial organisms and viruses, and I want to understand what they do, and I've found that if I begin to really understand what they're doing and their orientation and why they're doing it, then it's a lot easier to develop an intervention that can respond to it. And although I talk about using antibacterials to kill the organisms, my fundamental approach really is to set limits on their behavior so that your health is restored, and whether you still have them in the body or not, it actually doesn't really matter. There's a fair number of people that still have Lyme, for instance, but they have no symptoms and their quality of life is restored, so right. It doesn't actually really matter. What happens is if their immune function begins to drop, if they overdo it, the symptoms will blossom again. And as you probably know, there's nothing that will increase awareness better than a good chronic disease. You know,
yeah,
I mean,
that's
kind of what its function is, you know, to wake people up. So,
right.
So the thing about Bartonella is because it infects the endothelial tissue and it causes hyperplasia, which means it can block off blood vessels if you get too much overgrowth. So stroke is one of the symptoms you can see, heart problems, all kinds of things. So the first thing that I look at is normalizing and protecting endothelial cells and function. And the primary herb that I found for that is Japanese knotweed root. It's like if you designed an herb that could, you know, to treat this, our lime, both, you couldn't get a better herb than knotweed root. It really highly protects those endothelial cells. And, you know, I also suggest, basically the green tea catechins, which are EGCG and the quercetin mix for protecting those cells. And that right there begins to sort of limit their territory of habitation, and that in and of itself begins to reduce numbers. The organisms are extremely sensitive to L-arginine, so that's one thing that I also suggest, that researchers have found that just simply increasing L-arginine can reduce that a lot. Another herb I've been working with a lot in the last few years is an herb called Sida acuta. It's extremely commonly used in Africa. It's an invasive botanical, and I'm really a huge fan of invasives as medicine. But the neat thing about Sida is that it's highly protective of red blood cells. It helps stimulate the production of new red blood cells, and it protects the ones that are there, and if it stops infection in the cells themselves. It's the most red cell specific herb I've ever seen. It's also invasive in the United States along the Gulf of Mexico, so it's an extremely good herb for that, and we've seen really great results from using that for people. And then we protect those parts of the body, and then the other thing we do is stimulate immune function to help it be more vital. And just doing that, every researcher that's looked at Bartonella has found that the more the immune function goes down, the worse the symptoms become and the easier the infection takes hold. So I primarily use rhodiola and ashwagandha and cordyceps for this particular organism, and we've just seen a lot of really good success with it. The protocol is more involved in that because we look at protecting, you know, the lymph system because of spleen enlargement and the tendency of some Bartonella to infect the lymph and the lymph nodes, and red root's a really good protectant for that. The liver can be infected, so that we look at milk thistle seed, the heart, so we look at hawthorn. But those others are basically sort of a core that we found can begin to turn things around.
One of the ones you mentioned that's interesting is Bidens pilosa, which I know from my travels in the Caribbean and whatnot. I guess it grows in Florida and pretty much most.
It grows everywhere.
Yeah,
it's a world-class
yeah.
invasive botanical. I mean, we've got varieties of it here in the desert of New Mexico.
Oh, I see, yeah.
It's pretty much everywhere.
And that has a good effect on infections.
Yeah, the Bidens is an herb that's not well-known in the United States in the herbal community, and I got introduced to it. I've become a huge fan of the way many of the African nations are dealing with their medical problems. And many of the countries now have gone around to all the local villages and asked them what they use for various diseases. They collect the plants, take it back to their labs,
right.
Find which ones are the strongest, find what preparation method is most effective, find out how to grow it best, and then they go back to the villages and say, here's the seeds, grow it like this, use it like this, this dosage range, and you don't ever need pharmaceuticals again. They're trying to break the dependency of their medical system on pharmaceuticals because they can't afford it. So Bidens is one that they introduced me to because it's a primary systemic antibacterial and antimalarial herb, which is also invasive, which I like. And
yeah.
And the thing is, the tinctures need to be made from the fresh plant. But Michael Moore, the herbalist in the United States who was brilliant, was the first one that sort of wrote about it, though he was using the dried plant. And he said, if you've got any infection in a mucous membrane system, where you start to get well, then you relapse, you start to get well, then you relapse, Biden's will be the thing that'll kind of handle it. So
I first read about it with Dr. Dharmananda, who is really good in Ayurvedic and Chinese herbs, and he was talking about it as in Chinese medicine. Then I noticed it when I was on one of my field travels to Jamaica, and I talked to some of the Maroon and Rasta elders, and they said, oh yeah, we use this all the time for all kinds of infections and things like that. That's what got me so interested in
it. Yeah, it's a fascinating plant.
Yeah,
and we've started to find that with all of this co-infection group, if people are almost getting well, but then they sort of relapse, if we give them Biden's for a little while, it's kind of a thing that pops it through to the other side, and they just, it's like the final piece that takes them into that degree of health. So it's a much underrated herb in the United States, but virtually every place, every geographical location in the country has some form of Biden's that is invasive there. So, and I like these plants because, you know, once they're invasive, you basically have medicine forever. And,
yeah, exactly. You know. What about izatis? That's an interesting one that people have been talking
about. Yeah, that
about.
Particular one, I pronounce it izatis, but you know, I learned most of my pronunciation from reading. You know, I thought the word Ari was pronounced Ari for years, you know. Uh-huh. So when I talk, I am always embarrassed somehow. So I have no idea how a lot of these are pronounced. So.
Okay.
But anyway, that particular herb, izatis, is an extremely good antiviral. It's a nice systemic, but it's got a range of antibacterial action, too, and it's also a world-class invasive. It's very, very intense. It produces a lot of seeds. Almost every one of them will germinate. So once it gets established, it just really goes for it. And that particular one is very specific for mycoplasma, for instance. It's highly active against the mycoplasma organisms, and because it's so systemically spread, like the berberine plants, like golden seal, berberine's not very systemically available.
Yeah.
So even though it's a good antimicrobial, it pretty much has to touch the area. But izatis is extremely widespread. And I started finding there's a really interesting Chinese medicine database called CNKI that you can access through Google Scholar if you tell it that's what you're looking for. And they've done some great research on plants like this. They're getting ready to pretty much blow us out of the water. And they've found it really effective for a lot of things. And it has a really ancient tradition of use. So I've been real happy with it, except the fact that it tastes like spoiled cabbage, which puts me off a bit.
Very bitter, too.
It's not exactly one of those. Well,
yeah.
Herbalists take it and go, ooh, good. But, you know, everybody
else
goes, this
is terrible.
That's
the point. Now, should people, in your book, you talk about, you know, you give some interesting protocols. Should people put these in capsules or use them in tinctures? What's some of the routes of...
Well, a lot of the ones for these co-infections, a number of them I tend to like is tinctures because there's quite a few of them and you can just put them all together and, you know, take them at one time. One of the ones I particularly like to be used in the whole form is knotweed root. Because most people don't understand that when we take any kind of plant into our body, our stomach acids, our bile acids, all of the GI tract acids, the pancreatic enzymes, they're basically acting as an extraction medium, just like alcohol or water does if we make a tincture. So they pull out of the herbs what they really want. And Japanese knotweed root is... You know, it's a food-grade herb. You can take a lot of it. The only side effect is in about 1% of the people it causes a funny taste or a loss of taste in the mouth, but it's a pretty benevolent herb. And so I just usually recommend if people are taking that one whole that they start with a teaspoon of the powder 3 times a day and then work up to a tablespoon 3 times a day. And for Lyme, you end up taking it about a year. For these others, you're looking at 3 to 4 months, depending upon how bad the infection is.
And then I guess we only have a few more minutes, but you talk a lot about kind of balancing the immune system with kind of like amphoteric herbs, sort of like you mentioned cordyceps, which is one of my herbs of great interest now. Maybe briefly mention that before we need to sign off there.
Well, one of the places that we've really focused is because most of the people we see have neurological problems and chronic fatigue. So we're looking at protecting mitochondria and at the same time regenerating nerve function in the brain and protecting nerve function. And cordyceps is extremely good for protecting nerve function, and it's got some good function for mitochondria. One of the real great herbs for protecting and enhancing mitochondrial function is motherwort, for instance. Lion's mane is another great herb that's a mushroom that has neural growth factor in it, and we've seen a lot of good success. And kudzu root is extremely good for protecting and enhancing neurological function in these kinds of infections. So those are one of the major areas that we've really been developing and exploring, and we've just seen great success with it.
What's your website, Stephen, for those that are interested in finding out more about
it? GaianStudies.org, GaianStudies.org.
Gaian with an N.
Yeah, Gaian, okay. Like Gaia, the Earth.
Right, right. And your book's available all over the place. It's from Healing Arts Press, including...
Right.
Okay. Well, it's been quite a great discussion. We thank you for kind of giving hope for a lot of the people that may be chronically ill with Lyme disease. And
people need to know they can get well. It just takes a little time and focus.
Right. Thanks a lot, and keep on writing.
Great. Thanks for having me on.
All right. Take care. And that does it for another edition of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. We'll have to have Stephen on again to talk a little bit more about some of the herbs more in depth. Stay healthy, folks, and we hope you have a great day. Bye-bye.